Welcome to the Iced Tea Podcast After Show, the after show where we spill the tea about things that may or may not be figure skating. I'm Netta.
I'm Megan. What are we doing today, Netta?
Ladies and gents, this is the moment you've waited for. Yeah, we have tigers in the studio. Zendaya is here.
I'm currently astride an elephant in the middle of 1900s New York.
I have a full beard. What we're doing on the scale of may or may not be figure skating, this is firmly not figure skating, but it is so deeply important. Yo, I finally made Megan watch The Greatest Showman.
They finally wore me down at only... It took like 2 years.
It took like 2.5 years. This was my 6th or 7th viewing of this film, and I'm not sure how that happened in my life.
I haven't even seen films that are really good that I enjoy 6 or 7 times.
Okay, here's the tea. We have a family friend who works in like movie distribution. So when this movie came out, she was really kind and she reached out and she was like, hey, do you want to come see this movie? It's like a press screening for like people who write reviews and stuff. And she was like, you like musical theater? Come over and see this film. So we watched this movie. My mom came with me when that happened. And then we left the theater and I was like, as someone with a degree in musical theater, here's what was wrong with this. And they hated me for that, because that's not what you're supposed to do when people invite you places for free. But
yeah, but can I want to say this, like, my mom loves movies the way that they want you to love movies. Like, she's the ideal consumer of movies, because like whatever that director and that cast wanted you to feel about that movie is always how my mom feels about it. And even she fucking hated this movie. I remember, like, she loves musicals, and like she and my dad raised me on musicals. Like, she loves a musical. I remember her being like, it just shouldn't have been a musical.
It should not be what it is, for
it
so many reasons. Should not be anything. This is as far as I'd gotten in terms of preparation for this episode, was just making you watch this and then having us talk about it. I think we should kind of go through the plot of this, assuming there is one.
Oh my god. Okay, so there's like... Okay, so overall, like, thesis statement of this movie, like, it is aight, like, net neutral, because the music is good and then the movie is not good in ways that it's not just boring or bland or cheesy. It's like bad in ways that are so baffling and unique to me that I'm like struggling to articulate what exactly is weird and wrong with it. It's innovating new ways to make a movie strange and bad.
This is going to make sense to like one of our patrons, but I've been thinking about the disclaimer that they do on Small Town Murder, where they talk about how there is a murder that will happen on this comedy podcast, and they will make fun of the events around it. They're not going to make fun of the people who are affected, because they're assholes, but they're not scumbags. And I think we're going to have to do the same disclaimer, because the actual story around this, like the historical fact, is that P.T. Barnum was a garbage human being. He profited off of people with disabilities in unimaginable ways that, like, should not have ever been conceivable or illegal. Having said that, let's talk about this movie, because it sucks in so many ways that are not just, oh, we're, you know, making fun of people with disabilities and turning them into a show that people can go see.
Well, what Hollywood typically does best is take a real Oscar bait actor and use them to make a movie about a historically fucking terrible person, but like put that person at the center and make it like, oh, this is the protagonist and we're going to sympathize with this character and make them sympathetic. Mm. And like the movie could not even do that. It just like it didn't even do that. And it's so easy to make a historically terrible white man sympathetic in an Oscar bait movie. That's like what they are.
Yeah, I was
I just am baffled by it.
Yeah, while we were watching it, I was making, you know, this extended joke about how, you know, category is musical theater, like late 2010s musical theater about a historical white man who cheats on his wife a couple centuries ago. And, you know, it's very quiet uptown and we're all very sad about it, but someone's somehow redeemable. However, I'm not even going to go into Hamilton here. Barnum, there is a version of this film where he's completely, you know, sympathetic and we are guilt-tripped into caring about him. There's also a very nice version of this film where we know that he's not great and he's still the center of the story, but it's kind of like this, oh, you know, he reinvented a whole new form of entertainment. He was also a garbage person and cheated on his wife and blah, 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 allegedly. Instead, he's just kind of handsome.
I think it's worth throwing out there personally without going too far into the discourse that I just think that it's interesting that I didn't see like 1/10 of the blowback around this movie around like, actually, we shouldn't be making a movie about like celebrating somebody who was historically bad as I did about Hamilton. And I just think that's interesting, but whatever.
I mean, as a white person and also a person who doesn't have any visible disabilities or anything that like makes my life extremely hard, I can't speak to it, but I feel like there is a contingent of people who are way more inclined to, say, talk about racism than they are to talk about ableism. Now, that's not to say that those are not issues that are intersectional, and that's a much larger conversation than this Patreon show, but you're right. I did see that discourse, but I saw it on, like, the deepest depths of, like, Tumblr. Like 3 years ago.
Man, remember Tumblr?
Barely. Barely. It's no longer interesting out there. But yeah, no one's... I mean, we kind of... I feel like people... I feel like no one has the language outside of like academic circles to be like, hey, this is fucked up and here's why. Which is why we're allowed to have a movie about it. Explicitly about, hey, here's how we exploited a bunch of people, but it was fun.
Yeah, they loved it. They had a great time.
Yeah.
No, okay, I can't, like, this, yeah, we're not the people to talk about that. The thing about this movie is that it went wrong in so many ways that I'm not surprised it went wrong in. Like, I'm not surprised it didn't go into, like, the fucked upness of exploiting disabled people, but, like, just every possible turn, it took the least interesting thing to explore and explored that instead of anything that would have been cool. Okay, let me just say overarching issue I had with it. I think if you're going to take a historical time period and you're going to set it in a historical time period, and you're also going to make a very conscious choice about, like, the music is going to be anachronistic, it's going to be all pop rock bangers in the style of, like, late 2010s top 40, like, cool. But then you have to match that heightened musical aesthetic with a heightened visual aesthetic, and this visual aesthetic whiffed it so hard for me. Like, either go full, like, candy-colored, glittery, over-the-top, like, Moulin Rouge, Baz Luhrmann craziness, or, you know, not to use Hamilton again, but the way Hamilton kind of took a specific historical aesthetic but then stripped it down and kind of, like, half-modernized it, did it a little minimal, like, either go super far away from the musical aesthetic or super into it, but the way they did it was just, like, super boring, period-vague, Victorian, no consistency. I mean, you're, like, they're literally out here being like, this is the greatest show, and I'm like, they're in, like, Party City Circus costumes. I mean, God, we reamed Alexander Samarin so hard for his Party City costume, and here we are now. I'm like, that was nicer than what they had in the movie.
We're gonna get there, truly. Yeah, I agree. I'm thinking, I think Moulin Rouge is like a very good point of reference. I'm thinking, like, what's the exact opposite end of that spectrum? And I'm thinking of Water for Elephants, which does the very opposite, where it's like, you know, we're still in Victorian Circus, but it's like, oh no, this sucked. And it's like super dark and grim and like desaturated and all of that.
Yeah.
I would watch the shit out of a film about Barnum's life, which is just like gritty and like depressing, because that would make me feel something, I think.
Or
maybe, possibly.
Yeah, or what I was thinking they could do also is like, they could have taken it to a place of like kind of Victorian, but also kind of like modern high fashion, because if we're going to have modern music, like, why don't we just make it anachronistic? Like, this is something they actually do a lot. I've been watching a lot of like really terrible, like, quote unquote historical Korean dramas recently.
Yeah.
And they do this a lot on those where they'll put them in like the traditional historical costumes, but actually also like, this is just totally like a Gucci moment that's happening in the middle of like, you know, the year 800 in Korea, and no one cares because it's fun. Like, I would have taken that too, you know?
Not, I'm gonna stop harping on the discourse, but I wonder if seeing, especially this like circus ensemble, I wonder if seeing them in more modernized garments would have made it harder for the average viewer who will not be having this discussion to, like, consume this. Because there is a part of, like, the human brain, which is programmed, like, nowadays with the amount of media we have, presumably if you're not a horrible person, to be like, oh, this is probably something I shouldn't, like, be okay with. And I wonder if seeing this ensemble in like what like a circus act would wear nowadays,
like, you know how they did in like Natasha Pierre, etc., that show, like that's I think what I'm thinking
Natasha
of, like, that
Pierre,
kind of
etc., the rest
that's
of
how
them.
I call that show, but
just the rest of them
at all, that's what War and Peace is, Natasha Pierre, etc. Listen, so I agree with you on that. I think if we're as long as we're trying to have some kind of discussion about the aesthetics of this film, we need to talk about the terrible shake and go wigs and the bad like pastel porn eyeshadow on all the women.
I had a status about this on Facebook like years ago when I first saw this movie, where I claimed that the real villain was Rebecca Ferguson's lace front. Truly so bad. I've seen completely drunk drag queens cut a lace better than that. It looks like they went on like AliExpress and were like, red wig. And someone was like, $30? It's gonna arrive in 8 weeks. And they were like, yeah, that works.
Okay, but actually you bring up a stellar point, which is like, I almost, you've brought into focus something for me, which is that it feels like this movie wanted a bigger budget.
Yeah.
Is there an argument to be made for that? It feels like they didn't have enough money to make this movie good.
Okay, but their budget was $84 million.
They just bought, like, a lot of copies of Auto-Tune.
I feel like, I mean, I know there is a lot of CGI in this.
Is there?
I mean,
I wish
there was
more.
And shit. Yeah, same, but there's elephants and shit. There is a different way to apply those $84 million, and also, like, a Wigs and Grace wig is, like, $150 at best. And there is, like, two women in this show, so they might have, oh, I'm sorry, there's four women in this show, so they might have, you know, purchased four good wigs and fucking called it, but they didn't.
Okay, so as long as we're on the topic of women, another thing that kept coming up for me,
I just think that women,
I loved that all of the women in this show, we keep calling it a show, which actually we kept saying,
the greatest show.
It's not even a show. It's a movie, and it should not have been a movie, first of all. It should have either been a television series or a stage show, or, hottest take, I think it should have just been a concept album, because the plot was not of any importance to this show. The singing was the only good part, and they should have just made it a concept album, because it wasn't fun to behold with my eyeballs, and there was no plot. The lines were just, I swear to God, it's like there wasn't a script. It was like they were just acting out a Wikipedia summary with like massive things left out that we were just supposed to glean.
I think we should talk about what we actually see in this film, and then you can tell me more about this concept album, because I also have thoughts about what I would like this movie to be.
Okay,
so I have the plot open. We open on P.T. Barnum as a child. He's a tailor's son, and he wants to... Part of this narrative makes it seem like he invented the circus, but also...
Yeah! Okay, first of all, okay, so, like, look, we as, like, classical musical theater nerds, like, we love the premise that even a poor tailor is entitled to some happiness. Like, we're on board with that, okay, from the start. But...
Delighted by this.
But, okay, first of all, yes, the fact that I'm sorry, I don't know if I can say this without scream laughing because I like I can't. Okay, the fact that there's actually like multiple scenes that touch on the thing of being like, hey, circus, that's a word that I like. I'm going to take it and use it to describe this. What here we are doing, and it's like, no, what? What did it mean before? Like, it was so confusing. Like the whole thing around the word circus was fucking batshit insane. Like, at no point does this adhere to any structure that is widely considered to make a plot consumable or compelling. Right? It's like it starts out with a beautiful love story between two children who just met and are now in love. Children.
Fully children. They have, like, their, like, little Sweeney Todd by the sea moment, and,
I hate it so much. I hate it when I hate that, first of all, I hate that children singing love songs to each other is a genre, but also, I hate it because, like, if it's a boy and a girl, and they haven't gone through puberty, they just sound the same, and there doesn't need to be two of them at that point. Just have one.
Listen, it's very pure and beautiful when she's very rich and he is a poor tailor's son. So that's immediately compelling. And then we have a weird, weird time skip halfway through the song.
I just can't wait to be king. I mean, no, sorry, what is it? Is it Hakuna Matata? What's the thing in Lion King where he ages, where he's like,
it's Hakuna he's Matata. A child? They're like walking and walking and walking, and then they're walking and he's an adult lion.
Yeah, it's like that. We're in this film, this child is a child for 90% of this montage, and then we get one frame of him as a teen, maybe a different actor, maybe the same, I don't know. And then all of a sudden, he's 57-year-old Hugh Jackman. Like, I've come to wed your daughter. It's like, holy shit, bro, it's been a rough decade for
you. I swear to God, I'm not going to keep bringing up better musicals, but I know you haven't seen Bonnie and Clyde. Bonnie and Clyde is the only show that does that in a very cute, like, it works, and I think it works because it's a stage show, but it starts with Bonnie and Clyde, like, as children, like, in the opening number, and at the very end, like, the final verse of that, they harmonize with their older versions, and, like, their older versions, like, have their entrances onto the stage, and it's very nice and very,
like that.
Good for the audience. I'm gonna show it to you, like, when we're done, because I'm sure. That show. It's so good. Fucking love that show. But, yeah, the point being, I feel like if you're doing that on stage and you see, like, the child actor and then you see, like, fucking Jeremy Jordan and Laura Osnes walking on, it's like, oh my god, they're the same character, how nice! And you're, like, enjoying that because you're seeing, like, the strings that, like, make it happen. In here, it's just like, oh yeah, and P.S., here's Hugh Jackman, like, opening this door. Like, who cares?
Yeah, well, first of all, yeah, Jeremy Jordan, we both were saying how he would have been a better choice. Honestly, Jeremy Jordan would have been a better choice, or make Zac Efron this character, but, like, I just think that Hugh Jackman was too old to play this part, and, like, I don't feel bad saying it, because if this was a female character, it wouldn't even be a conversation. But I don't think that Hugh Jackman is a good enough singer to justify casting somebody that old as, like, the ingenue man of this show, this movie. Yeah. Sorry about it. I just am not a fan of Hugh as a musical leading man. I think his voice is, like, leathery and reedy at the same time in a way that is upsetting to me.
I think he's very hot, and I like his speaking voice. I really enjoy
I like him as Wolverine. Acting.
I love him as well. I just watched Wolverine, like, yesterday, because they've been marathoning all the X-Men films on TV. I'm trying to figure out how old the actual Barnum was, like, historically when he started the circus, because I feel like he began his career as a showman when he was 25, like, historically.
Yeah, I just, maybe the budget went to, like, making him look 25. I don't know if it would worked, but I will say I think it is buck fucking wild to have Hugh Jackman show up at the door at his future wife's dad's house, and the dad has aged not at all. Like, that to me was like, oh, we are in for one of these fucking movies where anything goes.
Yeah. I mean, again, not to bring this back to, like, Hamilton or anything, but if you were doing this on stage, you would be like, oh, of course they're not gonna, like, pay a different actor to be the dad for, like, this one scene.
Or,
like,
no one would care because it's far away.
Yeah, and it'd be like, of course you're not gonna do, like, old Valjean makeup for, like, this one scene. However, this is a movie, and their budget was $84 million.
Okay, another thing that I would like to say about this is that I think the entire first hour of the film could and should have been an extended, like, opening number that could be, like, 15 minutes tops, because I think that the pacing of this movie is some of the worst I have ever seen in cinema.
Yeah, here's the thing. In order to have that be an opening number, you're proposing that we have a central narrative, which we don't.
Which we don't. There's no conflict at all until, like, Act 7, when it just all literally catches on fire and everyone almost dies. No conflict. We're just seeing a man from humble beginnings succeed and succeed and succeed and never fail. It is fucking wild that this is the premise of this film. So we're seeing him win over the woman of his dreams, Michelle Williams, in a bad wig. And then they move on to a roof covered in sheets. It's just sheets and sheets as far as the eye can see. And they have two roughly 8-year-old daughters who look nothing alike that stay that age the whole fucking movie, which ostensibly takes place over the course of years.
Does it? Or is it just like one circus season? We don't know.
What is a circus season?
I don't fucking know. Like, I'm assuming like when it's warm and people want to go to the circus.
But it's like,
wait, hold on. We're skipping ahead. Can we talk about the fact that at first he opens up a museum and it's full of, like, just weird, like, things?
It's a wax museum.
It's like a wax museum, and there's, like, a giraffe and shit, and, like, no one's buying tickets to go see that, because even in the Victorian era, no one gave a shit about that. Like, wax museums are not worth it. And then one of his daughters goes, Dad, no, she says, Daddy, everything in your museum is super dead. You gotta find something more alive.
And then he remembers when he sees an apple that one time somebody with an unusual face gave him an apple when he was down and out as a child. And he thinks, I know, I'm going to exploit the disabled.
Yeah, he says, oh my God, remember people with visible disabilities exist? And that's like skipped over in the movie. He finds the guy who he ends up, like, employing to be, like, the little person's, like, stage name
is. Oh, he plays Napoleon.
He plays, like, a Napoleon, yeah, like, version. Historically, I'm looking at Barnum's, like, actual historical Wikipedia. It was, like, a Tom Thumb, like, character.
Yeah.
In the fucking film, we don't talk about the fact that he shows up to this guy's mother's house with, like, his birth certificate and is like, I know you got a son and I know he's fucking disabled. Where is he? Which means that he went to a hospital and was like, let me see the documentation for disabled people. And we just don't talk about that. And they just let him.
I would also like to say that this movie hinges upon the concept that no one would pay money to go to a museum to see wax figures or stuffed deceased, like, elephants and giraffes. And all of that does exist. Like, Madame Tussauds is a thing. The Museum of Natural History very much is just that. And, like, you know, that's all, like, pandemic notwithstanding, very much still alive and well. So I'm just, there's a lot of logical leaps being made. We also skipped over the fact that one of his daughters has a dream of becoming a ballerina, which we see play out over the course of the film as a motif, because the real greatest show is watching your children's shitty recitals. No, it's not. No one likes that. You cannot fucking tell me anyone likes that. The other daughter, her dream is to, and I quote, marry Santa Claus.
Listen, we all have dreams, and some of them are more achievable than others.
This is what I am saying. This film, at every possible juncture, picked the least interesting plot to explore.
Yeah. I mean, I would... Okay, here's the versions. We see... This could be a biographical film about Barnum and his relationships. This could be a film about, like, the rise and fall and rebirth of his circus. Could be a film about the performers, which would be fucking fascinating. It could It could be like a Zac Efron and like the fucking like that like love story film. That would fuck.
That would be rad as hell. Like, I would so much rather watch a story about like a well explored story about interracial love in a time of circus.
Yeah, that would be fucking awesome, and it could be very beautiful.
I would watch the two of them do pretty much anything because they're both super hot. But
well, yeah,
you know,
yeah.
Instead, we get what?
What do we get? Okay, so we they move into the rooftop with the sheets, and his daughters have questionably achievable dreams. And then they tell him that he should find living people. So we have this montage of just the most depressing auditions of all time.
But I do love an audition montage.
Me too, and it's very well made. Like, the visual storytelling of it is actually really cool. And, like, with the posters, like, seeing a person show up to the audition and then, like, seeing how they get rebranded. I think this is also the closest we get in this entire film to, like, well, one of the points where we really see Barnum is someone who's potentially really shady and is just grifting people. Because, like, when the very tall guy shows up and, like, introduces himself with a Slavic name, Barton was like, oh no, I think you're Irish. And then we see him rebranded as, like, the Irish Giant. Which, first of all, fuck you, no, learn to say his fucking Slavic name. Secondly, and then, oh, and then we see this weird, we see him discover Letty, who is, Kiala Settle's character in a very weird way where he shows up to her workplace.
Where they're making laundry soup just like the mom from Willy Wonka.
Yeah, it's just, she looks like she's in a regional production of Les Mis and is just like she doing does. Like at the end of the day, which she was in Les Mis in the revival in like 2014, and she was fucking beautiful in that.
So Hugh barges in and he's like, I am the mayor of this town.
Both of them are just briefly in the wrong show.
Yeah.
Both of them wish they were doing a better musical for a second. And then we find out that she has like fucking like polycystic ovary syndrome or something, and she has a beard. And he's like, oh, they don't know it yet, but they're gonna love you. And I'm like, Yaddy, well, she's fucking gorgeous. And then he gets a bad review in the newspaper. And that's heartbreaking for him, because he's never been told no in his entire life.
Never read the reviews, man. I gotta tell you, rookie mistake.
Yeah, he shouldn't have. But I guess, like, he didn't have, like, Twitter. He couldn't have, like, a hashtag to, like, see what
Listen, it's okay, Barnum. Even we got a couple bad reviews, and we're perfect.
Oh, yeah,
so.
And we're perfect, but also we sound feminine and shrill, and we curse a lot. Yeah. It's fine. I'm not bitter. I've not been bitter for half a year. It's fine. Go give us 5 stars if you haven't. So he gets a bad review in the newspaper from a guy who is supposed to be the antagonist of this film, I believe.
The only compelling character. The only compelling character in this film. It should have been framed around him like Salieri in Amadeus style. Like, that is one way that this film could have been fascinating. Just putting that out there for the writer's room.
Just, like, making it, like, Newsies. Like, it's from the perspective of a person trying to make headlines.
Well, yeah, because at the end of the film, he, like, sits down with Barnum and he's like, a different reviewer might have said that actually, and then he says all this interesting shit, and I'm like, so what's your story, man? You were totally just, like, writing what the people wanted to hear? That's a fascinating indictment of journalism. Like, yeah. That's making a point that is more salient than anything else this fucking nightmare of a film has put forward in my life in the past 2 hours.
So anyway, that happens, and our main man is very sad, so he goes to see a play, I guess, with his entire family, and there he meets the playwright/producer Philip Carlyle, aka Zac Efron, and he just kind of shows up and is like, hey, you're a producer, I work at the circus, what's up?
I actually really totally must have been zoned out for that. I never, here's the thing, is that I didn't clock that happened, but also there are so many points in this film at which we're just like told, like, by the way, this happened, don't worry about it, that it didn't seem weird to me that that would be omitted.
Yeah, so. It's just like there's a lot of points in this movie where we kind of skip ahead. Like, I'll be honest, when we were watching it and you were like, this feels like it's skipping ahead, because we may or may not have pirated it. I was like, am I making Megan watch like a cut version of this? And I checked the running time, and no, this is just the full film. This is just
So many times, it really felt like I was watching a montage that someone cut together to show, like, the plot highlights of it for, like, an awards show, and that we were missing, like, some scenes that maybe didn't show plot, but were, like, really important to the character development. Like, where did those end up? Are they in the director's version? Do I have to buy the DVD?
Yeah, maybe. There's, like, a 3-hour, like, Lord of the Rings version of this where they actually talk about things. But no, they go to... There's several instances in this film where it's just Barnum's family at a theater going through emotions, or like at a recital or at an opera concert or at the circus. They're just like sitting in the audience having emotions, which is valid of them. But he meets Philip Carlyle, who is Zac Efron. And I will take this time to say, when High School Musical was a thing, I was an emo kid and a goth, and I was really into reading French poetry, and I was actually into doing musical theater on stage. So I didn't care for High School Musical, and I missed out because Zac Efron is fucking hot.
Yeah, I've never seen it. I think I was actually just too old, but he's really fucking attractive, like out of control good looking dude. Yeah, and he's just getting better with time. He's also so short in this movie, and it works for him so well. He's such a little pocket prince, just like 5'8" so jawline, like, yes,
he's so cute. He reminds me, I mean, this is so obvious, and it's a bunch of bland, like, white leading actors with blue eyes, but he reminds me so much of, what's his name from White Collar? Matt Bomer. He reminds
Meghan
me of Meghan
Markle.
he reminds
is
me
the
of...
only actor I know from White Collar.
No, he reminds me of fucking Matt Bomer, just, like, the dashing, like, Prince Charming vibe.
I think of all of the bland white leading men, though, I would love to see him take way more roles than all the others. I think he deserves them more. I think he's a good actor. I think he can sing. I think he's handsome. Give him more roles. What are we doing, Hollywood?
I think a lot of people have the same baggage I do, like casting agencies wise, because it's kind of like, you know, the way like Daniel Radcliffe like stopped doing mainstream cinema and just does like weird horror films and like art films now and like theater, because anytime he does anything, it's not, oh, Daniel Radcliffe is a very, very good actor and here's what he's done. It's Harry Potter is so grown up. And I feel like it's kind of the same thing, because High School Musical was such a big thing for a generation, and like so many people remember, like Troy Bolton, Zac Efron, that like if he does, yeah, you know. And I hate that I could just pull that from my mind's palace.
It's okay, I was thinking it while you were like right before you said it. I was like, wasn't this douche's name Troy Bolton?
It truly is. But yeah, I think like if he were to go and do like a serious film, people would be like, oh my god, look at Troy Bolton. He's all grown up and like has a sharp jawline now and like whatever. Except, wasn't there like a whole thing where people claimed that he got a quote-unquote dad bod for like whatever he's doing now, and it's just like he has like 10% body fat instead of 6?
Yeah
People are dumb, man.
People are boring.
Not on him.
People are boring.
He's a very good actor.
So okay, he comes in the picture. Oh, I wanted to say also Michelle Williams is in this film, and I'm confused about why she's a person that people seem to want to repeatedly put in musicals. She's so beautiful and so wonderful, and I think she's so compelling on screen. But I don't know why she's a musicals actress now.
I honestly don't know. Could not tell you. But I feel like she's built a niche where people, like, think of her as kind of a singing actor. Perhaps, maybe. But I could not tell you. So anyway. Wow. So I got distracted because I just realized that Barnum was the mayor of Bridgeport, Connecticut for a little bit.
Weird.
I saw that on his wiki and just got so distracted.
One time I tried to get off the highway in Bridgeport to pee and there were no bathrooms. And that's all I know about Bridgeport. No bathroom. A lot of bridges, nowhere to pee. That's actually what it says on the sign when you go in the town, and that's on me for not seeing that. That's their motto, and
that's,
you know,
his new. That's his new circus. He's done with the circus, and he's doing Urinetown now. Thank you. Oh, it is a privilege to pee. So anyway, they meet at the theater. He straight up is like, "Hey, Philip Carlyle, you're beautiful."
Hey, Philip Carlyle, the man is loaded. Uh
oh. Oh, God, we can't keep doing this, Daniel.
You don't want to hear me rap? You don't want to hear me rap in exchange for money? Come on.
I would love to hear you rap, but the people have paid to be here and listen to this.
Pretty sure they've paid to behold my underground freestyling skills, but...
You could have been anywhere in the world tonight, but you're here with us on Patreon, ladies and gentlemen. The issue on the table is that they meet and then they're at a bar where there's no one else, and that bar looks like a craft beer commercial. And then they have, admittedly, probably my favorite number in this entire piece of filmed theater, in which they kind of, you know, they bargain about whether or not Philip Carlyle, who is, like, rich, he's old money and he has, like, everything, connections and blah, blah, blah. He's a trust fund baby, you can trust him. So they bargain, and then he's like, fine, I'll fucking join the circus. In the great tradition of Joe Johnson and Karina Manta, he's like, I'll abandon everything and join the circus.
When do we get a movie musical about Joe and Karina? Because that would rip.
Yeah.
That would be so good.
Please cast them to play themselves. It would fucking slap. But also, like, get Pasek and Paul to write a bunch of music for it.
Pasek and Paul wouldn't, because that would be a good story. And Pasek and Paul write great music for shit stories, and they've made a whole career on it.
Yeah. Oh my God, Megan, is the August bonus episode if we watch La La Land? I can't even say. I could.
Am I not suffering enough? Am I not suffering enough this summer that we have to watch fucking La La Land? No, I, listen, this song is well constructed. I can appreciate that. I didn't like the way it was performed. I feel like this is a point of disagreement here. I wish, this was the moment that I wished the most that this film had made different casting choices.
Oh yeah, because for sure.
Hugh is just not the right man to sing pretty much any of these songs except that From Now On song I thought he did a good job of.
Yeah, no, I think what I enjoy about this song the most is, like, the arrangement and the musical direction. I was saying while we were watching it that this song could not exist without Stephen Sondheim, and it's because in some interview that I wish I could quote, like, where it's from, but, like, Sondheim talks about Sweeney Todd and writing Sweeney Todd, and he talks about how he wrote Little Priest in a way where the timing has to be such that the actor playing Mrs. Lovett always has to be able to hit that rolling pin while she's making the pies because it's part of her singing. And I was thinking about how that translates here to, you know, the pouring of the shots being percussion and all of that. And I was thinking that Pasek and Poe did that just for me and no one else, because no one else who's watching this movie and enjoying this has ever read a word of musical theater theory.
This is a musical that is made by and for people who kind of know what musicals are but haven't spent a lot of time with them. And I know, like, I say this and I know, like, I know about Pasek and Paul's career and I know that that's not actually true, but, like, in spirit it's very much true.
It's, and I hate to say this, this is the kind of musical theater piece that makes me saying, hey, I have a degree in musical theater, have to be followed up by, but I get it, man. I know if you think it's cheesy and weird, I get it. Because there's people who've seen this in, like, the Cats 2019 film.
Yeah. No, 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 for real. And, like, I'm so with you on that. I think the moment when the little boy started singing to the girl on the beach in, like, the second number was the first time in my entire life where I ever... First of all, I did literally scream, "What?" out loud by myself in my room. And it is the first time in my life when I have ever in my life been surprised and appalled that an actor in a musical transitioned from speaking to singing. And, like, I was raised on musicals. I did them. I wrote them. I studied them in many different degree programs my whole life. I will defend to the death the concept that, like, a song naturally, organically taking over when the emotion is too much for speech is a fantastic mechanism. But, like, I did not think this movie musical understood that in any way. And no. I get it. I think it's bad and it made me hate musicals. And I'm sorry that I ever liked them. I was wrong.
In conclusion, I will be joining the NYU Business School this semester to change my ways because I'm full of regrets. No, but anyway, moving swiftly on from that, he convinces Carlisle to join the circus. And upon entering the circus, he sees Anne Wheeler, whose only reason for being in this freak show is that she is beautiful, gorgeous, talented, a trapeze artist, and insanely, you know, skilled in a very particular thing. She also happens to be a Black woman.
This film taught me that what it means to be a freak is to either be white and disabled or not white, but traditionally hot.
Yeah, there is a lot of just, like, weird racism and, like, fetishizing.
I want to clarify that that was me being, like, of critical course. Of the film oh and my not God, serious. Of course. Like, holy shit.
Half of the quote-unquote freak show is people of color in protective hairstyles wearing sparkly spandex.
Like, seriously, it just looks like the ensemble from, like, any indie, like, off-Broadway musical.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, it's...
Oh my god, a hot Black woman who can dance, but she's bald? Like, that was, like, half of it. Or, like...
Isn't that half the ensemble of, like, Hadestown?
Yeah, or, like, oh my god, like, a muscular twink with blue eyes, but he's wearing makeup? Strange.
One of the... And I know historically that was, like, a thing, and this guy is actually based on George Constantus or whatever his name was. The guy whose entire quote-unquote freak show talent is he has a bunch of tattoos.
Well, right. But I mean...
But, like, historically, that was, like, a huge deal.
Well, no, it totally was. And I still, I think if you have that many tattoos, it's still kind of crazy.
Like, yeah, it's still pretty
deserve,
awesome.
You deserve some attention if you got that many.
Yeah, but it's, I mean, the entire casting process, quote unquote, of this circus is really fucked up. Also,
I'm surprised some of them were actually, like, the thing that they were playing, but many of them could very easily have been that weren't, and that was baffling to me as well.
I was fact-checking a little bit. I will admit I haven't, like, fact-checked the entire ensemble. The guy who plays, like, the Napoleon character is a little person. He has been CGI'd to be, like, even shorter, and I think, likewise, I think the guy who plays, like, the very tall Slavic man is very tall, but they CGI'd him to be even taller.
The guys, I need to say this, the guys who play Chang and Aang are not only not twins, but based, I don't know this for a fact, but based on their names alone, it seems like one of them is Japanese and the other one is most likely not. So, you know, a lot of thought went into this, clearly.
The women who play the albino twins are both just blonde white dancers.
And, like, I could tell, like, I'm sorry, but, like, there have to be, like, amazing dancers who have albinism who could have had this be, like, one of their only shots to be in a huge Oscar bait movie musical so that was disappointing to me.
This is another thing, like, even if you were telling this garbage story about this historically questionable character, who, you know, was historically not a good man, if you had gone out of your way to cast this... like, the way it's supposed to be cast, and, like, give an opportunity to just, like, a whole ensemble of performers who, you know, will go through theater school and training and then never book a role because the theater industry is broken, and, like, Hollywood even more. This could have been huge, because, like, and not to keep going back to Hamilton and, like, all of that has its own problems, but, like, you could always be like, oh, you know, it's very problematic, but... it gave way to a lot of, like, actors of color who would never get booked in those roles before that. And now, like, a lot of other shows are wanting to do kind of the same thing because they're, you know, inspired by that or, like, by the success and whatever. And the capitalist reasons for that are a whole different story. But they didn't do that. I think the only thing they, like, truly, truly went out of their way to do was cast a little person as that one character because they would have just, like, not been able to get away with not doing that. So that sucks. In conclusion, that sucks.
Yeah, in conclusion, that sucks. Zendaya is great, though.
She's so beautiful.
Really, really great. I don't think there's anything Zendaya can't do in this world. Yeah, she's great.
Oh, so she is 2.5 inches taller than Zac Efron, which is just beautiful.
It's really hot. It really did it for me, personally.
Yeah, big same. So anyway, they meet, and he's immediately like, oh, she's hot. Who is she? And then the next scene, we had no character development. The next scene, he shows up, and he's like, I'm a trust fund baby, you can trust me, I've pulled some strings, we're going to London to meet Queen Victoria.
Nothing happens between those two events, it's fucking insane, and, like, the way we're just supposed to accept it, and it's, like, there's this thing of, like, oh, can people go if they're in the disabled ensemble, and then it's, like, no, they cannot, but yes, we'll go anyway, and then they go, and it's, like, so... Honestly, that whole thing was fucking buck wild to me. And then they meet a hot redhead who's hotter, I guess, than Michelle Williams, allegedly. They're both beautiful Hollywood actresses. I don't get that, but whatever.
Before we move on, I will say that, like, historically, Barnum did bring the little person performer to meet Queen Victoria, and it was, like, on record, like, historical records of this event show that, like, Queen Victoria was, like, entertained, but also, like, saddened by the whole thing, blah, 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 blah. So it's cool that they wanted to reflect that kind of in the film, but it's both, like, so big because it's, like, Carlisle being, like, hey, here's my connections, we're going to London to meet the fucking queen, but also, like, it's barely a moment.
Also, if the PBS Masterpiece Theater Victoria series has taught me anything, it's that Queen Victoria was actually, like, super sensitive about her short stature and, like, would not have taken kindly to having it pointed out and would definitely not have laughed, so...
You know what? That's relatable. She's a relatable queen. Listen, let me have this. I'm 5'1". I'm allowed to have this.
No, I was laughing specifically about the relatable queen, because she's you. A queen.
Oh, thank you. I'm a comedian.
Let me ruin Jenny your joke Lind, by explaining it.
Who, historically, she was a Swedish singer. We never find that out in the film because she just has a British accent.
The actress is Swedish, though. The actress is Swedish but has a British accent as well. So I'm like, well, at least that they went out of their way to cast accurately for some reason.
And it's this, I mean, I get it. We get, like, heightened whatever in film and theater. The second she shows up, it's like, oh, no. Oh, she's gonna be trouble.
She's a redhead. She's fiery.
Oh my god, she is a redhead, of course. And then she sings,
the best song ever.
Barnum convinces famed Swedish singer Jenny Lind to perform in America with him as her manager. She says, yeah, dude, sure, I'm just gonna come over. Who gives a shit? And then her first American performance is a rousing success. And during the song, like, a whole bunch of things happen, like Philip and Anne hold hands, and Philip's racist parents see that. But in order for that to happen, we get this opera singer singing this. Megan, you're the opera singer in this chat. Can you talk to me about how this song is? What is happening here?
Yeah, I actually really love this. I love that we're told repeatedly that she's an opera singer, and then she sings, like, a top 40 skrelt banger. Like, I'm all here for this. I loved that. I love being gaslit in this way. I don't know. It's a great song. I kind of didn't care. I thought it was funny. I think it would be really funny if, like, someone was like, I sing opera. And, well, okay, here's the thing. I actually do sing opera and that kind of music, but I think it would be really funny to really just, like, fucking bait and switch someone like that. I also love that at no point in the film does she ever sing a different song on stage. This is the one song she knows, but it's a good song. Like, it's the best song in the show to me.
It is. Well, no. I think fucking This Is Me is the banger, but that could be because it's queer. It's a queer anthem. We'll get there. We're almost there chronologically. No, but movie musicals like doing that. It's like fucking A Star Is Born, like the newest version of A Star Is Born, where it's always fucking Shallow. Like they meet workshopping Shallow, and then it's Shallow all the way through this entire film because it's so hard to write a bunch of songs.
It's like how Christine only knows Think of Me.
Jesus Christ, you're right, she does.
It's her one song. You know what? How relatable is that to just, like, bust your ass in voice lessons for years just preparing one song?
You know,
and then you audition with it, and then it's like, oh, I don't know anything else. All I know is, like, fucking that song from the Fantastics that everyone learns in high school. just once to wear my hair unfastened so it billows to the floor. That's it. That's the one.
You have transported me to a rehearsal room in Portsmouth. The one song that I always have in my repertoire for when people are like, you know, oh, bring your musical theater, but like, don't have it be like fucking last 5 years. I do 50% from the musical Ballroom, which no one knows, but it's a very sad song about a woman who is either a guy is cheating on his wife with her or she's like getting cheated on, but the entire song is about how she would rather have 50% of him than all of anybody else. It's very sad.
No, honey.
It's very You're sad better than you that. Get to like fucking not you, scream. Her. It's 1 a.m., so I'm not gonna sing. But she, like, her big moment is like this scream of like, I'd rather have 50% of him. And people always like that because it's very emo. Speaking of emo songs, this woman sings about how she will never be enough and like nothing will ever be enough, blah, 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 while dressed in a massive ass dress in front of a sold out audience in New York. She has a manager. She's booking a fucking US tour and she's like, oh, this will never be enough. Okay, whatever.
Well, the lyrics. No, it's the lyrics are like with if I don't have you, it will never be enough.
Yeah.
But it's also symbolic because fucking Barnum is insatiable with his greed. All he wants is that fucking dirty circus money and that love of the adoring public, man.
And it will never be enough. You know why? Because the man is nonstop.
Yeah, and the real greatest show is your daughter's ballet recital that you made along the way.
We'll get there. That final shot. We'll get there. So after this huge reception, we see him kind of like push away his ensemble, right? Because they have like this like after show drinks situation, and his performers show up and he's like, no, you can't be here, because like if you walk in here, why would people pay to come see you? Which, what a garbage thing to say to a person.
Yeah. But also, like, doesn't that really speak to, like, that interesting dichotomy between, like, performer and person? That's not what they meant, because they're not, like, smart and insightful. But of course not. You know.
Yeah, I mean,
I'm just trying. I'm trying to get anything from this.
but it will never be enough. So anyway, he says that, and then Kiawa Settle, fucking legend icon star, she had a stroke right before the Oscars. It was a whole thing. Have you read that whole story?
Yeah, I did. It was fucking wild. She's a fucking
hero. God bless her. I adore her.
And she is telling you that she's not going in this moment.
She is telling you that she is not going. She
Much like Wakabo Higuchi, who originated that song, I believe, if I'm not mistaken.
The original performer, Wakabo Higuchi. So she sings This Is Me, which is a queer anthem. This is about as much as Wicked is about racism. This is a song about being queer.
Oh my god, Wicked's about racism?
Oh my god, she's... dude, the green is a metaphor? Can you fucking believe? So she sings This Is Me, which I have seen done by every single drag queen that I know, and I know many of them. And let me tell you, it always, like, someone will step to the center of the stage in a bar or whatever, you know, back when we were allowed to congregate, and we'll start with whatever the first line of that is, I'm not a stranger anymore, or whatever it is. And you'd be like, oh, Jesus Christ, we're doing that again. And then 2.5 minutes later, you have all of your change ready to tip, because there's something so moving about some sort of queer person reclaiming all of those words. And it's very beautiful. I'm not here to say it's not a song about disability, but I am saying that it was very much written in a way where it could be. I think Pasek and Poe have been to a drag show before and knew what they were doing, is what I'm saying.
Do you think they saw Sideshow and just like totally ripped this from like that other song that's like kind of the same thing? You know what I'm talking about?
Yeah.
I love that song. It's a great song.
Sideshow
it's also
is so good.
Sideshow fucks.
So good.
It's a great show.
So good. Someone revive that. I don't know why you would in 2020, but you know.
Yeah, it would be weird, but
looking for things to do, I guess.
If you find a pair of conjoined twins who sing that well, then definitely do Sideshow.
Yeah, let them do that. So anyway, after that, you know, this is me, it's very beautiful. Philip doesn't just invite Anne out to a date because he, I don't know, has some hang-ups about it. So he invites her to the theater in a very convoluted way, and she shows up looking beautiful in this gorgeous, like, lime and pink dress. And then his parents show up again, and they're racist again.
Yeah, this movie really doubles, triples, quadruples down on the trope of, like, all important things happen in the lobby and or audience of an opera, which I love. I love that. And I applaud them for that. That look was a serve. I loved that. They then go and then have, like, kind of a sexy fight during a trapeze practice that he's a part of, which seems unsafe because he's not trained, doesn't know how to do that.
What is that Andrew Lloyd Webber show? Tell Me on a Sunday?
Yeah.
There's like a whole thing about a flying trapeze in that as well.
Yeah, man. Like, it's funny because the song itself is super intimate, and the entire time they're like fucking flinging themselves around this massive, like, stage. It's cool, and then you think about it and you're like, actually that was awkward, was sort of how I felt about it. It was sexy at times,
extremely hot. As someone who has flirted during like stage combat and like all other kinds of like emotionally charged rehearsal spaces, I think it's extremely valid of Anne to be like, hey, you know what, I'm good at this one thing, so I'm gonna like let him watch me do that. And I'm gonna sing about it.
I think I agree with you. I think the scale of it was wrong. I think it needed to be shot more intimately and not shot as though it's a massive group number in like a big empty theater with just the two of them. Like,
oh, just an intimate trapeze act.
Yeah, I'll say
that's just rope play.
That's
just rope. That's just rope king.
Sure, point. I don't care what they do to this movie to make it interesting at this point. Like, why not? I'm not gonna say no to any of that.
Laura, show me how to say no to this.
It's a good song. They it's do a good banger. Job with
There's
it.
Like a radio remix of it. It like still comes on the radio sometimes, and I always like kind of begrudgingly agree with it.
We're saying of all the songs that people skate to, there should be like, why don't Ice Dancers and Pairs skate to that like just inbuilt into it is like the acrobatic couples things. Like, yeah. That's a gimme to me, but
I wonder if it's too long / too short to be cut into any acceptable performance. I also don't care.
That typically doesn't stop people, but
you know what? You're right.
This can't be elegantly cut. Well, then we can't do it. Not on the ice.
God, I wish that were the case. So they sing about their feelings, and they kind of like, it is a classic conditional love song because it's all like, oh, we could, but like, we can't rewrite the story. So like, it's not meant to be like, sucks.
It was a little irritating to me that Zac Efron was like, why do you care so much about what people think? Why can't we just do what we want? And she's like, you're so fucking white, dude. Like, you, of course you can say that. Like,
he's incredibly rich and incredibly white and like, just
like, yeah, of course you can do whatever you want. Like, what do you mean care about what other people think? We live in a systemically racist society, my bro. Like,
we live in a society. But yeah, this is such a, I wish that were the movie. Like, I don't,
oh yeah,
I do, but at the same time, like, maybe it's time we just start showing interesting narratives about people of color and not narratives in which a rich white person shows up to like change a person of color's life. But that's a whole other conversation.
Let's have a movie about how Zendaya and her character's brother learned how to be trapeze artists as black people in late 1800s.
Yeah,
New York. That
I would
slap
like to see that
and be great.
I would like to see that movie, and then like Zac Efron shows up at like the very last minute to just be like roped into it.
Oh, well done. Is there an implication there that then there's a black circus that they learned from, and then like, because where else does one? And because I would love to see that, and what I have a lot of questions about that. But anyway,
I historically would not know. But after that, Barnum just decides to take his new pièce de résistance, Jenny, on tour for some reason, and he like hires a 60-piece orchestra, and he abandons his family to do that, And his wife has a questionable number about it called Tightrope.
I hate it. I'm sorry. It's cute. It's a cute song, but it's too cute for the subject matter. Michelle Williams didn't need a song. It's like they wrote the song and then they were like, it should be in here. I like the idea of a tightrope as a metaphor.
Yeah.
Also, like, stop writing songs about tightropes after Janelle Monáe did it. It's not going to be better. You think it's going to be fucking better than Janelle Monáe's?
Oh,
no.
Never, no. The thing is, though, I wish if we were doing a tightrope song, we did more of it. Because, like, our entire thing is circus. And then I barely get enough of this metaphor. And I'm like, if you're gonna give me tightrope, like, fucking give her the big number where she imagines herself as one of his circus performers. Because, like, if the whole thing is, oh, you're always gonna care about the circus more, have his wife imagine being a part of that. Like, that's so easy.
You know what? You're absolutely right. The thing about this movie that's been bugging me a little bit that I think you just, like, really hit the nail on the head was, like, the fact that the entire thing, like, the opening number and the whole thing is, like, dreams and spectacle. And, like, not a single fucking second of this takes place in, like, a liminal dream space or a fantasy. It's all very literal. It's all super, like, nothing about this is, like, non-diegetic. It's so weird to me, right? Like,
just the very opening, like the very, very opening is like a flash forward kind of.
Yeah, but it's nothing is a fantasy. Nothing is imagined or heightened or magic at all. It's all hyper realistic, to which I say, like, okay, in that case, why don't I just go see a circus now, which is going to have better technology and costumes than it would have had then.
And also,
I mean, because it's more expensive than seeing a movie, but.
And also presumably, like, hopefully the performers would be treated better, and if you're lucky, you might get one of those cool circuses where they have, like, holographic animals and no one's suffering. So that would be fun. Oh, you know what I do like in this song, though, is at the very end, there's a choreographical moment where she, like, imagines herself or, like, sees herself dancing with him, like, across their, like, big house. And then it kind of switches, and I think that's, like, the one second of, like, dream ballet in which she's, like, dancing with him. And then you see that she's just dancing with, like, one of the curtains. But it's a second. It's so little, and I wish it was more, because it could be good and it's not.
Yeah. And then there's, like, this whole thing where, like, the opera singer and Hugh Jackman, like, almost have an affair, but then they don't, but then she kisses him on stage anyway, and it's, like, this whole thing.
Which, like, for the record, is non-consensual. Like, he's a garbage person. That's still not okay.
No, totally. Yeah, totally. And, like, none of it's okay. At no point did I care about, like, anyone's relationship because they weren't sufficiently established for me to have any sort of feelings about them. The townspeople set the circus on fire at some point. Like, did I miss anything major before the fire?
Because
that's the first bad thing that happens in this film.
Yeah, so it's like she kisses him and he's like, okay, I'm done. And he goes home to, like, be with his family because he gets so scared. At which point, like, his wife doesn't know about that yet because, like, you know, it's, like, not nowadays, so she hasn't seen the pictures from that kiss, which happens on stage. So he comes home to New York, and he, as he arrives, the circus is on fire. So we have, like, this brief second where it feels like an episode of, like, fucking, like, Chicago Fire or something, because he shows up with Philip can't see Anne, so he runs in to, like, save her, and then around the corner, we see Anne, like, come out, and she's like, oh no, Philip went in. So Hugh
Jackman, like, a well-made play. There's a lot of people running in and out, and
it's fully a farce. It's entrances and exits. It's like classic theater. But anyway, no one dies, because why would they? Hugh Jackman barely saves Zac Efron, but he's, like, badly burned,
quote unquote, which is to say, at this point, Hugh Jackman says he's taken a lot of smoke, which doesn't sound like what one would say if they, like, were fluent in English, but whatever. And so he's like, quote unquote, badly burned, but really he just has, like, one aesthetic fake burn and, like, one Band-Aid on his finger. And Zendaya absolutely eats the shit out of this amazing scene where she's, like, crying and singing softly, and it's beautiful. And he's like, we're supposed to believe he's dying, but they kept him, like, so handsome and, like, not even charred a little bit, that it's like,
you know, that's valid of him.
Wait, I need you to tell you. Did you just tell the good people what you said about that scene, though? Because I fucking died.
Oh, that it looks like he's in the hospital ward in Harry Potter.
It's the same set.
It looks like they borrowed the same set from like the second movie where everyone's getting petrified. Also, trans rights and fuck J.K. Rowling. But it looks like it's the same set. But before that happens, before she sings softly to him and all of that, the newspaper gets printed. So. Two things happen. First of all,
the first 90 minutes of the movie, zero things happen. And then two things happen at the same time.
Two things happen at the exact same time. Number one, we get Bennett, who is the reviewer, like the theater critic. Him and Barnum have their scene in like the rubble of the burnt down circus, which you already mentioned, where it's like they sit down and they talk about like, well, you did bring people a lot of joy, and a better critic would have said like blah blah blah, the only interesting conversation in the entire film. But he also shows Barnum this newspaper in which it's like, oh, Jenny Lind is not finishing her tour, and also like here's the scandal and she kissed Barnum. So he runs home and his wife is like, oh, you cheated on me. I don't need to hear about it. You don't love her, but you also don't love me. You only love your circus. Also, the bank is taking our house, which, why? I still don't know.
The timing of that was suspect. It's also occurring to me now that there's another parallel with Hamilton, which is an affair is widely published and then a dramatic fire is also happening around the same time.
Which I was going to say while we were talking about tightrope like 5 minutes ago, this is where I would give Charity a song. Like, if you want to give this like lonely wife who was never appreciated a song, you don't give her, oh my god, my husband's far away and I'm sad about it. You give her Burn. Like, Eliza doesn't sing a major part of Take a Break because it doesn't matter. She sings when shit has happened. And I think, like, this is where I would give Charity a song about, like, oh, you don't love me, you only love the theater. Let me imagine myself as a tightrope artist.
Right.
It's right there. It's right there. It's not even hard.
This is one of the worst paced films I've ever seen in my life.
Yeah. So she takes their daughters to her parents' house, which, by the way, they live like down the street.
Deliberately.
Yeah.
As like a flex on the parents somehow.
I don't know. It's fucking stupid. Rich people are dumb. So Barnum goes to the bar because he's sad.
And he's numb. He goes to the bar numb.
Boo.
I deserve that. Go for it. Can we talk about how our recap is like the length of the film?
Our recap is genuinely approaching the length of the film. We're about half an hour short, but it's fine. This is way more fun than the film, I promise you. Megan can sing for us. It's going to be great. So he goes to the bar numb. The bar is empty again because it's like his personal bar. And then
it's too clean too. Like it's not that nice and it's too clean.
I'm telling you, it looks like a craft beer commercial.
It does. It really does.
So he goes to the bar, no, and then his entire ensemble just shows up and they're like, oh, I figured you'd be sad and like getting drunk by yourself here. And this band of quote unquote freaks teaches him about like the importance of love or some shit. They're all like, oh, you know, we all care about this and you showed us a thing that like no one else has given us. Oh, able-bodied white cis man savior. So he sings From Now On, which is a song which exists. Yeah.
It's very, like, Mumford & Sons. It's, like, the one song I think is well-suited to his voice. I will say I disliked... Okay, so, like, the second verse is, like, so good. And, like, then he kind of, like, has this moment where he's, like... And then I realized what mattered the most the whole time was right in front of me while he's looking at a photo of his family. And that was in a movie that is so on the nose that I genuinely, like, could not even see it because it was too close to my fucking face. It was the most on the nose thing. Like, I can't even tell you how just...
Yeah, it's... I don't even...
I have nothing funny to say about it. It was just bad.
It's just bad. But while that's happening, and then the beautiful ensemble kicks in, and anytime they start singing whatever it is, and you can come back home, and it's the ensemble, I am a musical theater kid at heart. It just, like, gets to me. But while that's happening, Philip wakes up, Anne is like, singing to him, and he wakes up and they kiss while he's like allegedly very burned and supposedly in a lot of pain, but they kiss anyway, which I don't know, if I got to kiss either one of them, I guess I would like suffer some pain for that as well. And then while the song is still happening, Barnum finds his wife who's been mad at him for all of 10 minutes, and then they're fine again.
There's this like beautiful shot of her on the beach, like being sad while staring at the sea, and her scarf is whipping in the wind, and it's so stunning and compelling. And I'm like, I said to Ned, I was like, this is the film. Like, this shot, build a movie around this shot. This is the most compelling thing I've seen in this movie so far. Michelle Williams being sad at the sea with the wind and the scarf. That's a movie that I would watch.
Yeah, that's a Greta Gerwig, like, Oscars 2022 film. Like, it could be a whole thing, but it's not. But anyway, he sings, like, half a verse of like the song they sang when they were babies, and she's like, oh my god, I guess it's fine, and she forgives him, I guess. And then he shows up again at the rubble of the circus, which is just very much a bunch of like smoldering rubble, and he's like, everyone's just hanging out there, which is weird, conveniently. So he shows up and he's like, hey, I've discovered the meaning of love and the purpose of doing art, but I have no money, so sucks, but we're done. And then Philip is like, hey, JK, I've had money this whole time. Let's be partners.
And then he's like, you fucking let them take my house? Oh, I guess he was in a coma, though, so that's excusable.
Yeah. I guess a coma is the excuse here. And I'm sure Barnum was
He did take a lot of smoke.
He did take a lot of smoking. He had to be kissed better by Zendaya. But yeah, and then Barnum's like, cool, we're going to be partners, 50-50, baby. And then they sing The Greatest Show again. And that's
it's
it.
It's like the Driving Rock remix. No, you missed the most important part of the film, which is that they discover that it's actually a lot more cost effective to put a circus on in a tent, to which I say, crazy that it ever happened inside of a building. If this was a well-written musical, I think that the line of like, and how about we put it in a tent, would be like a throwaway, but like really funny, memorable, like wink to the audience line in like the act one finale or something. Yeah. You know what I'm saying? You know the kind of thing I'm talking about, Netta? I think you do.
I do. I think, but
the,
also I'm
as
thinking,
the conclusion of the film, it was a little bit.
I'm thinking the exact opposite, actually, and I will disagree with, I mean, I see how you could do what you're suggesting, and I like that. I also think that could be such a huge moment if you milked it. Because, like, if I tell you, hey, get a piece of paper and draw me a circus, you will draw a circus tent. And the fact that this fire is what inspired this change and, like, made this how we see the contemporary circus nowadays. And I know there's circuses with, like, permanent bases. Like, I'm aware of that. But, like, the circus is a circus tent, and it's because of this one event. And I think you could milk that in such a cool way.
Make it a number, first of all. And also then reprise it later, and it becomes evident that a tent is actually a really apt metaphor for something else. But like, that's how you make a good circus musical, people. Are you listening?
Can we rewrite this? Can we rewrite the stars and also this musical? Because it has... No, can we rewrite this, but, like, make it not about Barnum and just make it about, like, a bunch of people who want to start a circus but don't have a tent?
I just think it should have just been a concept album. I still think it should have been a concept album. I think the music is the one good part about it, and the story is nothing. It's, like, an afterthought. It's very clearly just in there to tie things together. That's the only way I could think to punch it up, really.
I just wonder... Oh, and the last thing that happens is that Barnum, like, halfway through this musical number, gives Carlisle... his like ringmaster hat and his like cane, and like they switch because like it's not about who's the greatest showman, but like the emotion of being the greatest showman, I guess.
It's the greatest show is what makes the greatest showman. And may I just say, ringmaster Zac Efron is a fantastic daddy. Flavor that I didn't know I needed, but now I crave.
Oh yeah, it's extremely hot. I said some deeply inappropriate things in chat that just like came out of my fingers, and I was like, oh god, I'm not even
I didn't even question it.
You know I was valid. You know I was valid in what I said. Anyway, it's very hot. And then the extremely cheesy final act, like final scene of this, is Barnum, who is finally in the audience for his daughter's ballet recital, which, what kind of garbage teen movie from the early 2000s is this, that like your parent not showing up to a recital is like a running plot point.
Also, the other daughter is a tree, which I thought was fucking hysterical in a way they probably didn't mean it to be.
I think it's very charming, and I don't think they understand how funny it is. But yeah, like, the conclusion is, like, the greatest show at the very end is, like, him watching his daughters grow up, which I guess is cute. But no, I came here to see a story about the circus and not a story about your daughters.
He also almost tramples half of New York by riding up to the recital on an elephant, which is shitty for so many reasons. One, almost stepping on people. Two, where are you parking that elephant during the recital? It's gonna be like running wild and shitting on everyone during your daughter's ballet recital, which best case scenario doesn't interrupt the recital. And that's the best case scenario. And then three, imagine, like, it's your child's big day, your child who is already canonically bullied for having a circus parent, and you steal their thunder by showing up, like, fucking late on an elephant. Like, get the fuck out of here, Hugh Jackman. You're a terrible parent.
We fully missed the fact that one of the earliest signs of struggle in this film, like, old money versus new money, whatever, is when she does get bullied because her dad is rich, but he is rich because he owns a circus.
Old money versus new money will never be a compelling conflict. I don't care.
I don't care. Just, like, donate it to someone. Care. I don't give a shit. But that's the greatest. And this is the greatest show. That's it. We've done it.
And I saw it.
It exists.
And then we rewatched some Greatest Showman programs, because that was the inspiration for this, was that I would finally have context for all this greatest trend in figure skating in the last couple of years. So should we talk about that?
Yeah, let's. First of all, you say that, and it's making me realize that I'm not sure how that trend happened. I'm just thinking about it. I'm trying to comprehend, like, at what point one of the many choreographers in figure skating watched that film and was like, oh yeah, this is gonna be great for a thing. Because it doesn't, I don't know how it was ever compelling for anyone for this purpose. But anyway, let's talk about Alexander Samarin, which I will say, sitting down to watch his Greatest Showman felt like a homecoming for me personally, because I feel like there was a time in my life where we would talk about this program just like 4 times a month.
Yeah, it felt like every weekend he was doing it somewhere.
What a season that was.
What a good time. So, like I said, the costume that we were so critical of turns out is about par for the course for this film, if not better. The choreography blows, but I was saying to Netta, I was like, for a film that is essentially a variety of plot points and musical numbers with zero interesting, compelling character moments or fluff or frills, it's fitting to me that you would then represent that with a program that's, like, all tech and no artistry. Like, that's thematically correct for me.
Yeah, I agree. I think I've talked about this program so much. It, like, made me turn 180 degrees on Alexander Samarin, because I didn't care for him or this program before. And then I just criticized it so many times. And coming back to it, I think it's very cute because there are moments where you can see that he's, like, really into it. Which I think is always charming when you can tell.
Well, we watched one of his better performances of it.
Yeah. I'm trying to remember what it is. It's one of his triples in the second half of it, which might have been meant to be a quad. I don't remember. But it's placed so well. It's like the one piece of choreo which, like, just hits on a downbeat. And I'm like, yes. It's simple, but it makes sense. And I
honestly, like, I was so jaded after having sat through that movie that then watching that Alexander Samarin program, at least I was entertained, you know?
Yeah, he was having a good time.
The bar was so low for me at that point that I was like, yes, Sasha! Go girl, give us nothing!
Yes. Go girl, give us nothing. And then we watched Romain from this season, his long program, which was a Greatest Showman that we didn't really get to see a lot. I feel like we saw that like twice.
Yeah, it was a much better cut, I thought, musically. I thought rather than try to play a character in the movie, he just did what he does best, which is like wear a slutty black mesh top and kind of like be handsome and vibe to some good tunes and not try to insert himself in the narrative. I thought it was well done. That's how I think it should be done if you're going to do Greatest Showman.
I agree. I was sad that he did a boy version of that song. I forgot that he does like a cisgender swapped version of that one song. And I wish he would just like embrace it and just do like the original. But again, I really like From Now On, and when he starts doing the very intricate step sequence to that ensemble that I love so much. It gets to me. And also we watched him perform it at IDF, and you can just hear me hollering. So I guess I like it. Like, it's on record and I enjoy that.
Yeah, the evidence does state, if we play back the tape. I think I had said that I think that he could be like a Zac Efron of the skating world, and that he's just like classically handsome, white brunette man, kind of forgotten about often in a way that feels unfair and unearned, because he really is just a delight.
He is. He just has the vibe. You're like, you've summarized it so well. He just has
leading
this,
man,
like,
vibes.
Yeah, he, I would trust him with like the School Musical. And that's not to make a High School Musical joke. I just trust him to be like a reliable leading man.
And we watched the Zagorski
and Guerrero, yeah. Their rhythm dance from also this past season.
Weird music cut, but love them.
I love them and I love their energy so much.
It's so good.
I wish they would have had a bunch of Rewrite the Stars in there, because again, it's very athletic and a duet piece and all of that. I also resent the fact that they picked Greatest Showman in a year where their theme was musical theater. Because there's so much just like actual musical theater you could do. And I think anyone who does like, oh, well, Moulin Rouge is technically a musical, is just like copping out. But that's personal opinion.
Yeah, no, it's true. So I would be absolutely thrilled and fine with not doing Greatest Showman anymore.
We're retiring it. That's it.
Has there been another new movie musical that people can do?
Star is Born.
People have been kind of doing Star is Born. People have been kind of doing We Will Rock You. They've been doing Elton John. We need a new Oscar bait musical. I don't know why I said it that way. A new Oscar bait musical movie that people can latch onto.
I'm trying to think.
Do you think that the reason we haven't had one is because the skating season is maybe not happening, and the people who write the movie musicals know that if no one's gonna skate to it, then what's the fucking point?
You know what? You're doing this bit, and I just realized that they pushed In the Heights back 1 year. And I swear to God, if I have to see a white person skate to In the Heights next season, I'm going to be so upset. But I can see it happening, because that's the next musical that's scheduled to come out.
I mean, we could theoretically get more Hamilton just because of it coming to Disney.
Yeah. I would only care if Jason revives his Room Where It Happens as a gala program now with his haircut. Yeah. I would be here for that, and I would care for that.
You know what I would be okay with? Mm. Literally anyone skating to the Jason Derulo Rum Tum Tugger.
Tomoki Iwatashi, if you're out there.
Tomoki Iwatashi has fallen down the stairs at the Met Gala. No, I don't want to say that. I don't want anybody to get hurt.
Thank you all so much for tuning in.
Thank you so much for tuning in. I hope you enjoyed our dissection of this dumpster fire of a film.
Once again, thank you for keeping the lights on in our metaphorical studio. And once again, we will be donating a part of this month's receipts to causes that deserve it more than we do. Of course, before we go, Black Lives Matter, Trans Lives Matter, Disabled Lives Matter, extremely important to mention, especially after this mess of a film. But anyway, thank you for tuning in. We'll be back next month with not La La Land.
Yeah, Jesus, no, please. I'll sing us out. What should
please,
I sing?
Whatever you want. Go girl, give us whatever you want.
Go girl, give us something. I don't know the words to anything. Oh!
Ladies and gents, this is a moment of wait for.
Oh!
The bobby dippa da, the sweat soaking through the floor.
Oh!